You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's podcast is Jake Braun, who has worked at the intersection of politics, national security, and foreign policy for over two decades, and was appointed to prominent roles in both the Obama and Biden administrations. He wrote the book Democracy in Danger, and he has a new book called Fentanyl, Fighting the Mass Poisoning of America and the Cartel Behind It. You're going to enjoy the pod. Jake Braun, welcome to the podcast.
Kelly, thanks so much for having me. Really excited to talk to you.
All right. So when I prepare for a podcast, I read the book, I underline the book, I make my notes, and I either have an idea for the first question right away and I put that in there, or I don't and I sort of fill it in later. And I was very unsatisfied with my first question for you, but I was sort of like, I got a lot of things going on. It'll be fine. We'll just sort of get into it. And then I had this sort of brainstorm as I was going through all the things that I had written down, my notes from the book. So I have a new first question, which I'm going to read to you because I just wrote it and typed it out and ran back in here to get on the pod. So here it is. Your first chapter of the book is called Tyranny of the Urgent, which is actually a brilliant title. But it also feels like an incredibly important concept for your readers to understand, which is that to effectively respond to crisis after crisis on the national and international level, it requires a kind of quieting of your own mind, a reliance on excellent teammates and partners, and a willingness to pivot when things fail, which they always, always do. And this is the most salient reason that you're on a podcast that speaks to improvising your way through work and life. That sound right?
It sounds good to me. Yeah.
Okay. So before we jump into my questions going in that chapter, I mean, did you have preparation for walking into what you're walking into? We talked a bit before we jumped on the pod about, you know, you kind of grew up in partly in the Chicago area, went to Loyola. They're not teaching navigating, you know, ambiguity at Loyola at that time.
No, it's a great school. I'm happy I went there, but no, I mean, there's not a lot of preparation for this stuff except for doing it. And you know, particularly if you're at somewhere like Homeland Security, where I was for, a large portion of the book, these disasters come up and, you know, it's hard to prepare for withdrawing from Afghanistan when everybody thought that, you know, we were going to be there for months or years longer. You know, it's hard to prepare for, you know, a massive cyber attack that shuts down oil infrastructure throughout the country and has hour-long waiting lines for oil for the first time since the 70s. You know, nobody kind of plans for these in their job jar. And I think one of the things I forget if I mentioned it in the book or if I said it to you in the email, for the first several months that I was working on this, I literally couldn't spell the word fentanyl. Like every time I would type it, a little red line would come under it because I actually didn't know how to spell the word. But you know, you're kind of, when you're in the front office at an agency like that and some new disaster comes up, they look around, they're like, you're the point person, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned Afghanistan, the Colonial Pipeline cyber attack. You also had the assassination of Haiti's president. You had the border crisis with migrants. You had Hurricane Ida. I mean, this is like one thing on the top of there, not to mention all the things you don't mention, you know, that, right, that were going at the time. And you introduce us to Secretary, is it John Tien? Is that how you pronounce his
Correct.
Name? Yeah. So you were assigned to Tian to help him, you say, quote, see around corners at DHS and fix problems. So this feels sort of instrumental in terms of combining a sort of a general expertise of knowing a landscape with also what he brings to the table. So what, how does that work? And how did you two sort of come to start navigating this stuff together?
Sure. And I think actually, you know, our different backgrounds suited each other quite well because, you know, I had been in one form or another, whether it was a presidential appointee or a consultant at Homeland Security since the very beginning of 2009. And Tian, his first day at Homeland Security was the day after his confirmation in the U.S. Senate. Also, he had always been a part of massively large organizations, whether it was the U.S. Army, Citibank, or now Homeland Security. I had always been a part of essentially startups. You know, I'd started my own consulting company. I had done multiple presidential campaigns, which are startups because they go in and out of business, you know, usually in a matter of single-digit years or months. And so part of my job was to bring that historical knowledge about DHS and this is how things work and don't work and what you can get done and who's who and what's what, but also with this a little bit more of a comfortability with a less defined project plan, so to speak. You know, if you're at DOD, I mean, these people plan. The military, they are planners. They plan and plan and plan, and then they plan some more. A lot of times at DHS, it's like some crisis that we never saw coming happens, and all of a sudden we're all just scrambling around trying to figure it out. And I tried to bring a little bit of that sensibility into the equation when I was trying to help him see around corners, as you said.
So you also talk about this time, and this is the sort of post-Afghanistan or during that period, that Secretary Mayorkas insisted on like extensive vetting of the Afghans who were coming to the United States. And you note that, quote, the U.S. government may have collected more biometric information on the population of Afghanistan than any other country in the world, particularly on our enemies there, end quote. How? That like blew me away. Like, I don't know that people talk about that. How did we? And then why was that important?
Sure. Well, so since it was, you know, people at the time were calling it the Forever War because we had been there for, you know, two decades. So in the time that the U.S. military was there, and not to mention our intelligence agencies like the CIA and so on and so forth, every time they picked up a person of interest, whether this person wound up being found to have any wrongdoing or was put in prison or killed or whatever, they got their biometrics. They'd take their fingerprints. They'd take sometimes, depending on the technology they had, a scan of their retina, their voice, their face. So real biometrics. In some cases, folks got DNA, depending on who it was. Then, of course, anybody we put into prison, you know, we had all of their biometrics. Then at the same time, if a bomb blew up in a marketplace in, I don't know, wherever, some small town outside of Kabul, some poor private was sent out there to go pick up fingers and you know, things like that. And anybody who was involved, or if there's shrapnel, get fingerprints off the shrapnel and all that type of stuff. And all that went into a database. And after 20 years of doing that with, you know, thousands and thousands of military personnel and intelligence folks collecting all this, you know, you wind up with a pretty robust database of the biometrics on more people in that country than, you know, probably any, well, then certainly for the U.S. anywhere else on the planet.
And that's foreshadowing how you might have used that in this fentanyl crisis. So can you pinpoint when we knew that there was this, well, A, like people hadn't even heard of fentanyl. I mean, I was still thinking like the oxy stuff was the right issue. So when did we and how did we know that this was a problem?
Yeah, so at the very end of Obama, people started to realize like, gee, there's a lot of people dying of this drug that like nobody was really using before. And then Trump, to his credit, gets President Xi to agree to basically make selling fentanyl illicitly in the U.S. illegal in China. And so then that forces fentanyl into the black market really forces distribution of fentanyl into the hands of cartels, and in particular the Sinaloa cartel. That's when it really goes through the roof. And then in 2022, we get numbers back, and it had been steadily rising for a while, but we get numbers back from overdose deaths in the United States that shows that it was over 100,000 deaths directly tied to overdoses, most of those fentanyl, in just that 1 year. And by way of comparison, normally heroin and cocaine together combined kill about 10,000 people a year. So you're talking about a 10 times increase of overdose deaths. And that kind of macabre, milestone, I think really hit everybody like a ton of bricks. We knew it was a problem, but once you hit that many dead, you're just like, oh my God. And that's when, you know, they start throwing everything in the kitchen sink at it.
And unlike heroin or pot, what you note is that a lot of the people who are ingesting fentanyl have no idea they're ingesting fentanyl.
Exactly. I mean, this is why it's just a categorically different problem than previous narcotics epidemics. This is not a redux of crack cocaine. It's not OxyContin. It's not even like, you know, the morphine addiction after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Because in all those cases, people at the very least knew that they were ingesting those drugs. Now, in the case of morphine and OxyContin, people didn't know how deadly they were or how addictive they were because the medical industry wasn't telling them or didn't know themselves. But in the case of fentanyl, it was hidden in people's drugs like cocaine or heroin or anything else. But then later, what gets far more insidious and far more dangerous, and when we really start to see the death toll spike, is when the cartel starts to put it in fake illicit or fake prescription drugs that most mm-hmm. people who are taking those drugs think are real prescription drugs. And maybe they got it from a friend. Maybe they got it from whoever. They didn't get it from a pharmacy. But nonetheless, they think it's real when in fact it wasn't. And then that's when you have these horrific stories of some kid, for example, who thought they were taking an Adderall from a friend, albeit, you know, they shouldn't have, but they were taking it to study for finals. Mm-hmm. And they wind up dead because that Adderall had no Adderall in it, but it did have fentanyl in it. And all of a sudden now they, you know, one pill and they're dead.
So you're tasked with teams of like trying to solve this, fix this, however. And I would think most people would think if you don't go to the root, if you don't go to the root causes, there's no way of you having an effective strategy here. But you point out that the problem with that is that to get at the root causes would be a take forever, right? Was that the issue there?
Right. Well, and it depends on which root causes you're talking about. Are you talking about the root causes in Latin America or the root causes in the U.S.? Because,
yeah.
If you talk to the people, if you talk to the Chinese or the Mexican President Obrador at the time, you know, they usually point to, you know, decline of U.S. values and family structures and all these things that, you know, we could debate whether that's relevant or not. But, fixing U.S. families or the decline of religion in America or whatever. I mean, a lot of people would debate whether that needs to be fixed in the first place. But anyway, so that's one set of root causes. Then the other set would be, you know, what's giving rise to the cartels and so on in the first place. And, you know, we're really bad at nation building. And that's kind of what this would take to go fix, you know, the economy in rural Mexico or Honduras or somewhere like that is a perfectly great goal to have from a humanitarian perspective or even a diplomatic perspective in terms of improving relationships. But in terms of solving this problem and solving somebody from dying a month or a year or even 2 years from now, it's not going to really get at the problem.
So instead, you went to hunting coyotes. So tell our audience what are coyotes and what was that strategy?
Sure. So the way migration kind of used to work, you know, years ago, particularly before 9/11, was, for those of you who, I don't know how old you are, but based on the color of your hair, I assume you're, you know, generation of mine or a little bit older. You may remember the old Cheech and Chong movies where, you know, they'd show mm-hmm. a bunch of guys, usually all guys, who are at the border and they kind of run across and, they one or two border patrol agents tackles two of them and the other ones are, you know, whatever. Well, that is not the way it works anymore. It used to be buy a bus ticket, get to the border and just run, you know. Then after we start erecting all this border infrastructure to see who's coming across the border, particularly because of 9/11, and concerned about terrorists getting across the border. Then you had to hire somebody to tell you what routes to go and who you had to pay off and so on. And that generally was, it was somebody's uncle who had moved back to the States or something, you know, and this guy took money, but he was essentially just an illicit travel agent. Over time, this becomes a well-funded industry of people where these people's uncles or whoever, who was the guy who you pay to get you across, now have totally been co-opted by the cartel infrastructure. And there's video that we had of somebody trying to just walk across the border like they did in the old Cheech and Chong movie. And a pickup truck with presumably cartel guys in it comes, picks the guy up, beats the hell out of him, throws him in the back of the truck and takes him away. Now, of course, we find out later that the guy winds up getting across, so they think it's that guy. So presumably his family was extorted for more money or something like that. And then he was able to go. But the way the border works now is radically different than it has been really until just, you know, the last 20 years and even more so the last few years.
So the Chinese play a role in this, and then Russians are showing up in San Diego. Is that you don't know why, and you're sent there, and there's this phrase that they're all using, which is such a tell, right, that there might be something weird going on. Can you talk to us about Putin's long arms?
Oh, Putin's long arms. And I forget the actual Russian phrase, but so, right, we start to see, as you said, all like thousands of Russians showing up at the southwest border, almost all in San Diego. And we're like, what is going on? Like, these things just don't happen, you know, like randomly. And so we think that it may, you know, uncover something for us related to fentanyl and some of the other issues we're focusing on. So I go down there and I start talking to these folks. Most of them are in their 20s. They're like young folks who presumably, honestly, could just be refugees that are fleeing Russia because it's in the middle of an unlawful and horrific war. But our interest was like, how are they getting here? Like, what's the mechanism? You know, what is the involvement of the cartels? Really, is what we want to know. And so we find out that they're all coached. And one of our biggest tells, as you're saying, is they all say, or I start saying, well, why were you coming here? Why don't you just go to Europe? It'd be so much easier. And they're like, well, Putin's long arms. We have to escape Putin's long arms. And what they were referring to, it seemed, was the guy, Novoshenko, Novoshenko, I'm not pronouncing it correctly, yeah. Who was like a Russian intel agent who was in a famous story where he's in the UK and gets poisoned. I think his daughter gets poisoned too or something. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not getting the story exactly right, but you get the point. Yep. And so they're all like, well, you know, pointing to this example. And I'm like, no offense, but like your nurses and teachers and construction workers or IT workers or whatever, I don't think Putin cares. And they're like, no. But Putin's long arms extend everywhere. He doesn't care if you're important or not. You know, the only place that we can be safe is in America. And you know, it's great to hear, hey, you know, we're, you know, the greatest country on earth, blah, blah, blah. But then you start to be like, you're all saying the exact same line, you know, that leads me to believe that there's something going on here. And of course, we come to find out that we don't know exactly the details, but it seems to be that there's some deal between the Sinaloa cartel and Russian organized crime, which seems to be dominated by local law enforcement in Russia, who have facilitated this deal with Sinaloa to send these Russian migrants through San Diego.
So let's talk about the history of the Sinaloa cartel, because, I mean, if this were an American business, Fortune 500, Fortune 100, higher, Fortune 50?
Oh, Fortune 50, yeah.
Jesus. All right, so how does this start? And tell a bit of that story, because it's amazing in terms of how we got to where we're at with this cartel.
Sure. You want me to start from like the beginning, and I'll try and go
fast? Yeah.
Okay. So basically back, you know, over 100 years ago, there's folks who worked on the Mexican side of the border, and, you know, they'd find out about things that, you know, the people wanted on the U.S. And so there started to be like, you know, a good normal kind of trade routes and so on. Some of it was illicit, or most of it was illicit. Some of it was maybe less so. But then the as they're building the railways across the United States, you know, Chinese migrants come over. Some of this was happening at the tail end of the Opium Wars. Poppy seeds are brought from some of the migrants over, largely to really not to sell to the rest of the U.S., but to service the rest of the Chinese population that had come here, you know, that had been dealing with that crisis in China. And those migrants wind up getting, you know, abused and not treated well in the U.S. A bunch of them moved to Mexico, where unfortunately for them, they didn't get treated much better. But it turns out that poppy seeds grow really well in the climate around Sonora, what they call the Golden Triangle area, where turns out that some of these folks who had been trading across the U.S. or across the Southwest border were like, gee, we could just run this heroin that was coming out of these poppy seeds back to the United States and serve the Chinese population that was there. So there started to be that's kind of where these kind of gangs, which is really more of what they were, started. Then, you know, my favorite, the U.S. temperance movement gives them the best gift they could ever ask for, which is prohibition. And so now all of a sudden, these guys who are really like poor farmers and whatever, just kind of like, you know, making a few bucks here and there, all of a sudden this becomes a massive global industry where they're moving booze across the border from Mexico throughout prohibition. And that really gets the cartels started. They have to have infrastructure. They have to have a corruption racket to pay off the government officials and others who would have otherwise stopped them, distribution channels, all this type of stuff. They corporatize in many ways. And then then prohibition ends. Things die down a little bit. But then again, U.S. temperance movement steps in again. And what do? They, for all intents and purposes, make marijuana illegal in the United States. And so now the cartel's like, oh, hey, look, we have a new thing to sell. And so here we go. So now they're growing marijuana in where? The Golden Triangle, because, of course, that's a perfect climate to grow marijuana, just like it is poppies. And so then it kind of takes off even more. And we start to kind of move into the 60s where, you know, smoking marijuana becomes almost like a rite of passage for a lot of young people and so on. And these guys are making money hand over fist. Then enter Mr. Pablo Escobar and a lot of his friends from Colombia, who are starting to get the screws put on them by the Reagan administration, particularly in the Caribbean, where they had been moving, you know, thousands of pounds and tons of cocaine into the United States. And I think there was a Time article that called it America's drug at the time or something like that. And the guy, Guillardo, whose name I'm terrible at pronouncing, I'm just going to apologize at the outset now for I'm going to butcher everyone's name that I say for anybody else. But anyway, so Felix Guillardo, who was kind of the El Chapo of his day, sets up a deal with the Colombians where he's like, look, I'll move your coke for you, but I want a good deal on, you know, he sets up terms with them. And basically, they take over the distribution trade of cocaine into the United States. And that was, at the time, the Guadalajara cartel, which eventually essentially becomes the Sinaloa cartel. Them and a couple other competitors take over moving cocaine into the United States and then distributing it by and large from the Colombians who don't want to mess around with it anymore and just be wholesalers. So then, you know, they kind of plod along for, you know, decades, making literally billions and billions of dollars off marijuana and cocaine, super popular drugs in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Over time, two things happen to them that they could never, ever imagine or, you know, couldn't have predicted. One is we legalize marijuana, essentially, you know, just saying we're not going to fight over it anymore, which crushes their marijuana business or craters their mm-hmm. marijuana business. And then for whatever reason, cocaine's just not that popular in the U.S. anymore. No. You know, in the 80s, you know, at the height in 1985, 6.7% of the population had done cocaine in the last month. Now it's down to 0.3%. Our math says that that took about $23 billion a year out of the Sinaloa cartel's pockets annually, obviously. So $23 billion a year they lose just off cocaine. And I think our math showed another $40 billion or something like that off marijuana cratering. So just catastrophic. It'd be like if you went to McDonald's and said, sorry, guys, you can't sell hamburgers and French fries anymore. But good luck. Keep trying to keep your business afloat. And so what do they do? There's no bailouts for cartels, you know, so well, in many ways, they are too big to fail in some parts of the world because they're so integral to the economy. They still don't get bailouts. And so what do? They move into taking over the migration trade, as we just described. You know, you can't cross the border without paying off the cartel now. And about half of that is the Sinaloa cartel. And then Sinaloa in particular, I think because of their relationship with the Chinese, literally dating back to the Opium Wars in the 1800s, have really strong relationships with Chinese chemical companies. You know, Trump has just had Xi shut down the trade to the U.S. directly from China. All the drugs start to go through Mexico, and in particular, mostly Sinaloa. And they start to squeeze more money out of their heroin and coke by putting fentanyl in it because it's super cheap and super addictive. And then really where it starts to explode, as I said, is they start putting it in illicit prescription pills. Prescription pills that look like real prescription pills. And then now, like, Sinaloa has a lot of lines of business, dozens if not hundreds, but their two cash cows are now fentanyl and migration. In just really 10 years, they've made this massive switch from cocaine and marijuana to fentanyl and migrants.
It's incredible.
Some business school, whether it's Booth at University of Chicago, where I teach, or wherever, should really do a study on this. It's maybe the most dramatic corporate turnaround of modern times.
Well, yeah, and all of it, right? Like, why do people not want to do coke anymore? I mean, so I'm turning 60 this year to age myself. So I certainly grew up in a cocaine environment. And you know, part of it, here's part of what I would think is, like, no one ever wants to do cocaine alone. And people are alone way more now than they are. So, you know, that could be one thing. I don't know. Cause you just talk about yourself and you don't want to talk about yourself to yourself. But also to tackle this problem means on the sort of US side is you have to coordinate through all these departments that are just laden with bureaucracy, but you guys kind of do that, right? I mean, you kind of, like, you get a lot of people working with each other. How does that happen? Is that top down, bottom up, a little bit of both?
It's got to be a little bit of both because there's two kind of countervailing factors. And honestly, you see this a lot with the Trump administration, not that I want to go there too much. But if you, as the president would say, if he can kind of mandate things from the top, but if he has the rank and file, I will not refer to them as the deep state. They're just good people trying to do their best. If they decide, hey, you know, we don't think this is legal, or sometimes if they just disagree with the policy, this is the part where Trump is kind of right about it. You know, they'll slow roll you to death. You know, if they think your policy's wrong. So you need to have the rank and file bought in if you really want to achieve something. But you also need the mandate from the top, because if it's just me running around telling everybody, like, hey, you know, this is a good idea, let's do this, I'll get some of them to agree with me, and a bunch of others either won't agree or have another priority. So you have to have the prioritization from the top to be able to say, no, the boss says that this is what we're doing. And then, but really, if you want it to work, you've got to do the hard work of, like, you know, coercing, controlling, getting people on board, taking people out to dinner, but also, you know, moving people off the project if they're not going to be involved. You know, like, you know, carrot and stick and doing the hard work to get the rank and file to be with you.
So we talked earlier about in Afghanistan, the technology aspect. And in the chapter, which is called The Digital Arm of Democracy, I thought this was just fascinating. And you write, quote, much like private sector, the government rarely innovates new technology from scratch. Instead, we identify our desired capability and search for existing components that could be combined in new ways to achieve the goal, end quote. And here you refer to the National Targeting Center and the Cyber Crime Center. So what did those two technologies come together to do for you in this fight?
Sure. So the National Targeting Center was stood up after 9/11. You'll see a lot of this kind of harks back to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it was basically made to really prevent another 9/11. So it was it monitors people moving around the planet, particularly on if they're inbound or outbound from the United States. But then also cargo. So it will analyze cargo going nearly anywhere on the planet, particularly into and out of the United States. That was all about weapons of mass destruction and terrorists. But we quickly realized, like, oh, well, guess what? You also happen to know about all these cartel folks because they're all in the database, or maybe not all of them, but anyone who's been arrested or is suspected of a crime or whatever is in there. And then, of course, the cargo is the fentanyl precursors coming from China to Mexico different containers and stuff coming from Mexico to the U.S. And so we quickly were like, oh, great. Well, we'll just use this. And so we'll aim it at this other problem. And it wasn't like we were the first brilliant people to think of this. There were others who had been using it for kind of bespoke cases and initiatives related to this stuff. But it wasn't until we were like, no, let's aim the whole thing at this big, suite of problems. And so that's number one. Number two is there was a program at the Innovation Lab at HSI to basically go after crime online, in particular, going after child pornography, child exploitation, that type of stuff. And wound up getting involved in looking at these like online illicit marketplaces. The Silk Road is probably the most famous mm-hmm. one that I talk about in there, and how there were folks from HSI who were like actually had hacked into the Silk Road and had been impersonating people in the Silk Road and actually operating as moderators of some of the content what was going on Silk Road, selling drugs, guns, blah, blah. I mean, not that law enforcement was doing that, but they had gotten into it. And with us looking at so much of this happening online and what was coming from China, which is all much of which is happening on the dark web and elsewhere, we were like, oh, well, how about we just use this group of law enforcement agents and their digital tools who learned kind of the regular gumshoe stuff early on, but now have this sensibility that they can take these tools and aim them at the cartel, aim them at the Chinese chemical companies, et cetera, et cetera. And so two things created for very different purposes. One, stop another 9/11. Two, stop child predators that could be turned into use for this problem set.
So how successful were you at the end of the day? Fentanyl use went down? Where are we at? Are deaths down now?
They are. I would like to say just before I say the number that it wasn't enough. Too many people are still dying.
Sure.
There's still heart-wrenching stories. I mean, once you've heard enough of them, like I have, if they just think about my kids all day, every day about like, Jesus mm-hmm. Christ, how do you escape this? But anyway, okay. So that being said, after about a year of this, fentanyl deaths went down nearly 40%.
Okay.
And so despite what some may hear from some corners of the internet about fentanyl, only getting worse up until very recently, it's actually not true. After this campaign was launched within 16 months when the numbers started to come back. Overdose deaths were down nearly 40%.
And is there an element of this campaign that is still going on now? Are you privy to that?
There is. And by the way, I will say on the overdose death number going down, it's so unusual to see a drop like that. I mean, this is not how crack cocaine ended. It's not how OxyContin ended. It's not how, morphine ended, any of those things. The journal Science, obviously one of the most reputable scientific journals in the world, actually studied this to just figure out what in God's name did this, because we just never see drops like that quickly. And they argue it's likely because of supply chain disturbances between the Chinese and the Chinese chemical companies and the Sinaloa cartel, well, the Mexican cartels, but that largely means Sinaloa, which would add to the whole enforcement aspect of this, not to pat ourselves on the back too much. What was your follow-up question? Sorry.
No, I think you answered it, which is it's still going on. Both fentanyl is still coming to this country. We're still trying to fight it. I wonder if we have departments that are working together and communicating in the same way, you know, given the sort of dysfunction of how we see everything running. But, you know, these things are cyclical and, you know, something's going to replace fentanyl.
Yeah, I mean, well, and one of the things I would hope is that if we can bring enough heat down on these guys, which we, I mean, what we did against them when we first started this was not the type of enforcement activity they've seen in a very long time. And the layers in which we were hitting them at all, blah, 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 that, you know, I think that this will wind up being a different animal. But at the end of the day, I think that if you look at what the administration is doing, there's a couple good things and a couple bad things. Obviously, I'm a Democrat. I work for Obama and Biden. Mm-hmm. But I really don't like the Democrat view of like anything these guys say has to be wrong just because they said it. You know, I don't think that's how we get out of problems and make progress. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things I call for in the book is that we needed to do a better job of having a centralized, at least one, if not a couple places where you'd have the military, the intel community, the diplomats, the law enforcement folks, et cetera, all in one place, all sharing intelligence and all having shared plans to go go after the bad guys and also, you know, intercept drugs and so on and so forth. I will say they've really made a lot of progress. The current administration, the Trump administration, has made a lot of progress on that front. They're doing some stuff in terms of coordination that I think is really laudable. At the same time, you know, one of the number one things that folks in Mexico said to us every time we would talk to them, every single time, was, look, these cartel guys would be so much easier to beat if they weren't armed to the teeth with an arsenal made in America. And I have not seen much progress in the last year on that front. It is an American problem. Look, I, you know, I'm all for the Second Amendment. You know, Americans have a right to bear arms. However, cartel members in Mexico who are not American citizens do not have a right to bear American military grade weapons at all. And so there's a lot more work that could be done to defang these guys so that they would be easier to beat. There's also a lot of work in cybersecurity or in cyber offense that, you know, we started to make some progress on. You know, a lot of that's classified, and I'm not privy to every classified thing. So maybe they're doing a lot more than I'm aware of on that. But I do think that getting after the Sinaloa cartel in cyberspace is something that really needs a lot more focus.
Well, I think that's the thing about when you read this book and you're just like, oh my God, it's all connected. Whether it's guns, it's immigration, it's drugs, it's policy, like the list is so, privacy, right? You know, the fact, you know, the you know, I read this the other day because it was someone talking about how everyone was quoting Broken Windows in the 90s, you know, as somehow that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And that turned out to be kind of bull. But there are other elements that were true inside that. And today, you know, you look at like crime and you're like, well, you know, it's a little hard. I mean, crime's down. I mean, look in Chicago, we work with Crime Lab, you know, I think that's how we met. And, you know, of course it's down because our photo is being taken every time, right. You know, I mean, it's like the Ring camera thing is you can't get enough of that online now. It's Ring cameras right. For days. So I'm very intrigued. You said you might have a couple yes and stories. I want to, you can deliver one, you can give us two, whatever you want, but I'm fascinated by that question for you.
Sure. By the way, on the point you just made, I think it's Ben Franklin who said, those who would trade freedom for security deserve neither.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Which I agree with. Okay, yep. So my two stories are, you know, you can cut one. Oh, well, you can cut whatever you want. It's your show. But I'll give you two, and if you want to use both, fine. That's okay.
Great.
So when I was in right after undergrad at Loyola, I decided I wanted to live abroad for a year, and so I applied for a program in Japan, some English language teaching program that I didn't get accepted to. And so somebody was like, oh, go to Taiwan. It's easier. And I'm like, okay, well, how do I apply for their program? They're like, well, you don't. And I'm like, well, what do I do? They said, we'll just call the consulate because there's no embassy there because it's Taiwan. And so I literally just cold call the consulate and I say, hey, I'd like to move to Taiwan. How do I apply to get some English teaching job or something there? And they're like, oh, just come over here. We'll find you a job. There's not really a way to apply and get hired. Just show up and you know, we'll help you figure it out. And I'm like, well, I got no place to stay. I don't know anybody there. I've never been there before in my life. I don't speak Mandarin, whatever. And they're like, don't worry about it. Just show up. And so I said, okay. And I bought myself a plane ticket with an open-ended return date. Mm-hmm. I got myself a month's worth of nights in a youth hostel, which is the cheapest thing I could find, and just showed up. And that's how I wound up actually working in journalism, because I wound up working at an English-speaking newspaper there shortly afterwards. So that's story number one.
Okay.
Number two was, so I come back from Taiwan, and I've been working in journalism here as of the Daily Herald for a short period of time, and then started working in politics. And one of my bosses, who was this, like, you know, in the dying age of the machine, like one of the last old machine guys, says to me, hey, you know how you're talking about foreign policy and you want to work in that space? And he's like, so I know this guy running for president, and he's the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate. And I was like, okay, great. Who is he? He says, John Kerry. And I said, well, I've never heard of him. And he says, well, neither have I. But if you want to work for him, I can probably get you a job. But the catch is you have to move to Iowa. They're not going to pay you much, or they'll put you up on somebody's couch. So you can, like, you'll be living in someone's basement on their couch, and you need to be there in like 3 weeks or whatever it was. And I said, okay. And mm-hmm. about a month later, I was living on somebody's couch, working, for John Kerry, making, I think, you know, $2,200 a month or some ridiculous number like that. And, you know, he lost, but that got me into the bloodstream to work for Obama, which, you know, ultimately did wind up working out.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, it is, there's so much to unpack in these stories. And one is a thing that we teach here, which is that you, to be innovative, creative, fulfilled, have purpose, have meaning, you have to be comfortable with discomfort. That is the good stuff all lay there. And unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, COVID being one of them, the fact that we can design our spaces for convenience, which is like we don't have to talk to a person, that all these things are working against us being uncomfortable because we don't have to be. And you kind of have to choose and design your life. This has been my experience completely, to exist in those places that are hard at first, because what you come out with is the riches of relationships, connections, knowing that you can do that thing, that you can show up at a foreign country not knowing the language without, I mean, that's craziness. You should not have done that, but you did, and it set you up for your stuff.
For sure. I think one of the things that I always try and tell young people, you know, since I'm teaching at University of Chicago, is to read lots of biographies of even people who maybe not are exactly in the field you want to go into. Because what I've learned over the years is that they've all got not one, but a dozen stories like this. And that's part of the way they got to where they were is the yes and, you know, some crazy thing comes up and they're like, yeah, okay, sure. You know? And so I think once they see, what's hard for people is they think, well, But what if something goes wrong? Once you read dozens or hundreds of biographies and see that all these successful people did exactly the same thing, you're like, okay, well, if I want to be successful, I'm going to just have to make the jump too, you know?
Yeah, and littered with wrongs. I mean, this everything from Steve Jobs, Edison, Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, like you name it in what field is that the majority were the failures. But that's
without question.
But that's also true with athletes. It's like Michael. I'm sure you're a Jordan fan like I am. It's like he didn't win every game.
Right.
Best ever. He was the GOAT. Didn't win every game. Okay. The book is called Fentanyl, Fighting the Mass Poisoning of America and the Cartel Behind It. Love the book. Jake Braun, thanks for being on the pod.
Thank you so much, Kelly. Really appreciate it.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.